This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. As the November 3rd election deadline draws near, we wrap up our look at the propositions before voters. Joining me for a conversation about the potential changes to rent control, property taxes, data security, and how the state charges theft-related crimes are Ben Christopher, election reporter for Cal Matters, Olivia Allen Price, host of KQED's Bay Curious podcast, Jeremy White, California political reporter for Politico, and Mark Trezza, instructor of political science at Fresno City College. So as I look at the propositions on the ballot this year, it seems like there are several what I think of as deja vu propositions, old ideas that are back in front of voters yet again. And I'd like to start this conversation with one of those propositions, which is Prop 19. So this is an idea to amend the state's property tax system, but this time has a slightly new twist to it. Olivia, can you give us a rundown?
Yeah, so Proposition 19 is, you know, really looks at property taxes in California and would allow certain groups of people to transfer their property tax rate from one property to another. Now, of course, this all kind of harkens back to 1978's Prop 13, which basically set it so that the tax assessment rate that you pay is tied to the purchase price of your home. So the longer you're in your home, the less you're paying in property tax relative to market rate. And what that did was basically give homeowners at the time a predictable and affordable tax bill and helped a lot of people stay in their homes. But long term, it's meant a lot less money for local governments and a lot less money for schools. And there's also been a concern that people are sort of staying in their houses longer than they ought to be, because if they move, suddenly they're going to have to pay, you know, a lot higher of a tax rate on a similarly priced home. So what Prop 19 basically does is would allow certain groups of people to take their property tax assessment with them. So basically put it on the moving truck and move it to a new home. So instead of paying market rate tax at this new home, they'd be paying sort of that reduced rate that they were paying in their old home. And the three groups that would kind of benefit are seniors, which this defines as anyone over 55. Now, I know a lot of, you know, 55-year-olds who would be offended to be called a senior, but they might smile because they're benefiting in this situation. People with severe disabilities would be able to use this as well, and people who have been victims of natural disaster, like wildfire or, you know, an earthquake or something.
So, Ben, you've been reporting recently on the big funders in these proposition campaigns. Give us a sense of how lopsided the contributions are to get 19 passed.
Yeah, it's pretty lopsided. So on the one hand, you have about $43 million coming in to support this initiative. And that's mostly coming from the realtors, because this is a big item for the realtors. They've been pushing for this for a few years now. And in fact, there was a proposition on the 2018 ballot that would have enacted exactly this policy, and it failed fairly miserably. And so now we're back again with this policy, and there are a few other sort of provisions that were meant to be sweeteners to get the support of the Democratic Party and some other key interest groups. And so that seems to have worked, in the sense that you have a ton of money on one side, that $43 million. And on the other side, you have about $23,000 the last time I checked. So it's incredibly lopsided. And that same goes for sort of supporters and in terms of the endorsement race. So you do have the endorsements, obviously, of the realtors, who this is sort of their issue, but you also have the endorsements of the California Democratic Party and the California Teachers Association, the big union representing teachers in the state. They are actually neutral on this, but that was seen as a big win for the realtors, because it was back in 2018, their opposition really helped tank the this proposal from 2018.
So speaking of 2018, you know, one of the things that's different this time around is this idea of the inheritance tax loophole. Jeremy, maybe you could talk a little bit more about that and give us your sense of whether or not you think that will be enough to persuade voters to support this proposition.
Certainly. You know, this is an issue that has been spotlighted in the media. The LA Times in particular did some great reporting on it. But California's property tax laws, as written, essentially allow people to claim those lower property tax rates when they inherit a home, even if they're not actually occupying that home as the principal residence. They may be renting it out, using it as a way to generate income. And so this initiative says we should do away with that practice. And, you know, I think more so than the appeal of that particular element to voters sort of in a vacuum, I kind of side with Ben on this one, in that the proponents of this initiative have so much money and are going to spend what they think they need to spend to convince voters. I think it has a better shot simply because of that sort of lopsided imbalance of cash.
Mark, what are your thoughts? And especially given, you know, this is one of two propositions on the ballot that are potentially going to chip away at Prop 13 and the protection of property tax rates. Do you think this has a chance of passing?
So I'm glad you brought that up. But yeah, this goes back to the 70s, right? And if you are close to that 55-year-old age, senior status, you were probably in K through 6 or junior high at that time when Prop 13 first passed, right? Sometimes the third rail of California politics, don't touch it. And this is going right to that. And so this is, again, for me, it's a fairness issue. And I think it, you know, with all the money, it may be one of those few propositions that pass. Generally, I mean, with 12 on the ballot, maybe 3 to 5 will pass. This may be one of those, and the money definitely helps. But back in 1978, when Prop 13 passed, and then eventually it made its way all the way up to the Supreme Court, and it was validated in 1992, the U.S. Supreme Court basically said, hey, it doesn't have to be fair, but the government has a reasonable reason to enact this tax law that penalizes new buyers. And so this inheritance tax is one of those things for new buyers you might see as unfair. If you're inheriting, well, it's a nice benefit. If you are protected currently by Prop 13, good chance you're more of a regular voter than not. It's a general statement, I get it. So all those factors, I think, portend well for Prop 19. You know, we'll see. But yeah, this is a similar issue when it gets back to rent control and that measure on the ballot in terms of fairness. Property owners have advantages worked into them, right? It's homeowner rent control, in essence, on your property taxes. That's what Prop 13 does. But when you talk about rent control, that's a different proposition. We'll have the same debate again in a little bit.
Well, let's go ahead and jump to it. Let's move on to Prop 21. Jeremy, can you give us an overview of this proposition?
Absolutely. So this is essentially a redo, sort of like Proposition 19. It would make it easier for cities and counties to enact rent control. It's currently quite restricted by a law that was passed in the 90s. And it's the same sort of players as last time. The principal supporter of this is an organization called the AIDS Healthcare Foundation. Their leader, Michael Weinstein, is a pretty controversial guy in California politics, I would say. And that organization, after spending millions of dollars on this in 2018 and losing pretty resoundingly at the polls, is back again this time. There are some tweaks to the initiative in terms of making it easier for small landlords to avoid rent control and sort of creating a rolling window for which properties are covered. But it's effectively a statewide rent control ballot initiative.
Olivia Allen Price, you host KQED's Bay Curious podcast. You've been looking into these propositions. Voters rejected a similar measure back in 2018, I should say. Why is it? Just explain a little bit more why it's in front of voters again.
So the people who are pushing, you know, Prop 21, I think they learned some things the last time around. And one of the things they learned was that people were sort of uncomfortable with the idea that, you know, rent control might hurt further development, right? We're in a housing crisis, and there's just sort of this thinking, you know, we need more units. And so rent control would discourage building. So what they worked into the bill this time around was that buildings that are 15 years old, buildings have to become 15 years old before they're eligible for rent control. So anything that's, you know, going to be newer isn't going to be eligible for rent control, even if a local government does pass a new measure. And that basically gives developers some sort of certainty that they're going to get a return on their investment. So the thinking is that it won't hurt development as much as some people argue that other rent control measures could.
Ben, do you want to jump in and weigh in on this?
Sure. No, I was just going to add to Olivia's point that I think another key difference is that this is 2020 rather than 2018. There's a presidential race also on the ballot. And so I think probably for the sponsors of this particular initiative, there's a thought that because there's going to be a higher turnout election, there will probably be more Democrats and Democratic-leaning voters, more liberal voters who might be more receptive to this message.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Valley Edition. We're talking about propositions with Ben Christopher, election reporter for Cal Matters, Olivia Allen Price, host of KQED's Bay Curious podcast, Jeremy White, California political reporter for Politico, and Mark Tretza, political science instructor at Fresno City College. Well, let's move on to another proposition. Might as well take on Prop 24. So in 2018, California led the nation in the passage of a data privacy law. But the man behind that legislation thought the law did not go far enough, which now brings us to Prop 24. Ben, let's stick with you. You're covering elections for Cal Matters. What's at stake here?
Yeah, right. So as you said, the person behind this is a man named Alistair McTaggart. He's a real estate developer in the Bay Area, the San Francisco Bay Area. And he just decided that large tech companies were gathering just way too much data about consumers. And so he floated the idea of a proposition in 2018, ended up getting taken up by the legislature and passed as what is now called the California Consumer Privacy Act, which at least on paper is the strongest data privacy law in the country. In practice, I think it's a little bit more complicated, partly because regulations on the act are only now just going into effect. So a lot of people are still kind of figuring out exactly how it's going to be enforced. But yes, as you said, McTaggart felt that the law really didn't go far enough, that the legislative process kind of watered it down, gave too many giveaways to the tech industry. And so now he's back with what he claims will strengthen the law. It's a very long proposition. And so it's also very complex. And so I think there's still a lot of uncertainty about how this would all work in practice. But some of the big changes that he wants to make to California privacy law is making it harder for companies to share data, not just sell it, but basically share it without a consumer's consent. Also increasing penalties for violations of the law, giving more funding to the Attorney General's office to enforce the law. And McTaggart, he's basically the only major funder of this initiative, but he has gotten some other sort of high-profile endorsers from the likes of Andrew Yang, the former presidential candidate, Congressman Ro Khanna in Silicon Valley. But the sort of interesting thing about this is that you might expect, given that it's a big privacy law, that it's a face-off between privacy advocates and big tech. But in fact, this is actually a fight between different privacy advocates and consumer groups. And so you have groups like the ACLU, the League of Women Voters, the Consumer Federation of California, and they're all opposed. And they make a handful of arguments against Prop 24. One is that it's so complicated. It's this 50-page long document written by this one very wealthy guy, and it would just be better if the legislature kind of handled this. And then another component of their argument is that Prop 24 does include some measures that would allow companies to charge consumers more if they demand not to have their data collected. And so they actually say that's an anti-privacy measure. And then, a third argument is that the Privacy Act is still very new. The regulations are still just kind of going into effect. So there's another argument that, well, maybe we should just wait to see what the current law actually does in practice.
So, Mark, you're a political science instructor at Fresno City College. Any sense of how voters are going to respond to this proposition?
When voters are confused, they vote no. So if I had to guess, this won't pass. That's just a guess. But I think, as Ben was saying, the average person is just confused on this. And it's like a marriage that's broken up. One of the lead opponents of it, I believe her name is Mary Ross, she was the co-author of the bill that passed in 2018 with Alistair McTaggart. And she's opposing it. And her concern is there is so much more that needs to be regulated. And that view from some of those privacy or think tanks, if you will, public citizen, they just don't think it goes far enough and it lets big tech get away with too much. If I did my research correctly, Mary Ross used to be on the House Intelligence Committee. So she's kind of aware of what big tech has on you and I and is concerned. And this is the plight of direct democracy in California. We have direct democracy, so we can decide this policy. And is it wise that voters do this as opposed to it goes through the legislative process where you can have public testimony, you can have committees, and this is why we elect leaders to study the issues and make smart public policy. This is an area that's emerging. The new law has just got into effect. I think there are a lot of unknowns, and this is a philosophical question of whether or not we should be voting on this. Are we impacted by it? Of course we are. But will we make the best policy in this fashion? And we have opposing sides, as revealed in the groups that are concerned about privacy. They can't agree. And so this is where we are, Prop 24.
Well, you've raised some fascinating questions, and there's a lot to chew on here. But let's move on to our final proposition that we'll be discussing today, Proposition 20. So California voters seem to flip-flop when it comes to their views of criminal justice. You know, I'm dating myself, but I remember the 1980s and 90s when the state had a reputation for being very tough on crime. You know, that era saw the passage of the three strikes law. But then things pivoted, perhaps as a result of prison overcrowding. You know, we saw public opinion shift, and just not too many years ago, voters approved propositions giving prisoners early release opportunities and reducing some felonies to misdemeanor crimes. Now Prop 20, it appears, is bringing the pendulum back in the other direction. Jeremy White, a political reporter for Politico, tell us about Prop 20 and what it could mean for the state.
I think you teed it up perfectly. As you said, California has kind of embodied over the last few decades the extremes on criminal justice. It was a sort of national leader, if you want to call it that, on mass incarceration. It's notorious three strikes law during a tough on crime era. And then in the last several years, whether it's the voters at the ballot box or the legislature, we've seen California enact more and more policies intended to reduce sentencing, reduce incarceration, and try and move away from that era. And so I think Prop 20, which is backed by law enforcement, is sort of a gauge of whether the electorate is on board with that or whether they want to moderate and move back in the other direction. So Prop 20 essentially rolls back elements of two voter pass propositions from 2014 and 2016. It alters Prop 47 from 2014 by increasing the penalties for certain property crimes. Prop 47 had reduced those to misdemeanors. This would make some forms of property crimes what's called a wobbler, so it could be charged as either a misdemeanor or a felony. And then it would roll back elements of Prop 57, which passed in 2016, then-Governor Jerry Brown's urging. That law made it easier for people who are incarcerated to earn earlier release, to be paroled earlier. This would make it tougher by expanding the list of violent crimes, which make you ineligible for early release. It would give parole boards more ability to deny parole. So this is essentially law enforcement saying, we need to pump the brakes a bit. This has gone too far. And they are hoping that voters are on board with that.
Olivia Allen Price from KQED, tell us who's for this proposition and who's against it. Do the opposition and support of the proposition fall under sort of traditional lines, the kinds of folks that we would typically expect?
I would say for the most part, yes, there are a couple surprises. But yeah, generally this is backed by law enforcement groups, the Republican Party, people who are sort of interested in a return to more of the law and order, you know, philosophies that were more dominant in the 80s and 90s in the state. And then people coming out against it are people who have generally been behind criminal justice reform. You know, former Governor Jerry Brown is on the list, the Democratic establishment, you know, our current governor. I think what's sort of interesting and sort of new to the space is there are some victims groups who are sort of coming out in, you know, opposed to this one. And that's really for a couple reasons. But one of them is the changes that were made by some of those earlier propositions actually shifted some money away from, you know, obviously incarcerating people towards rehabilitation and victim services. And so if we are moving back into a place where people will be behind bars for longer or for crimes that right now they might not be behind bars for, that's going to deplete a little bit the pool of money that we have available for rehabilitation and victim services. They also are sort of contending that, you know, putting people behind bars isn't always what victims are most interested in. There might not be the most healing in that. So they have some interesting, just a new approach, I think, into how they think about this.
So, Mark, you're a political scientist. Help us put this into some context. You know, we're talking about this criminal justice reform at a time where we're having a national conversation about, you know, police brutality and inequities within the criminal justice system. Do you see that movement influencing the outcome of Prop 20?
Well, that's always possible. Obviously, the easy answers we'll know once we count the votes. Surely, depending upon voter turnout, something Ben referenced earlier, being a presidential election, whoever the actual voting electorate turns out to be, yes, that definitely can have an impact. I just wanted to add one other point from the support side in speaking with a law enforcement sheriff. Part of that wobbler type of crime that falls between whether it's a felony or a misdemeanor, and sometimes there's dollars amount included in the actual, read the language. You commit crimes over $950. It used to be a felony that was reduced with Prop 47. But the impact of that, what district attorneys or sheriffs may tell us, is that a negotiating tactic was removed. And now that you no longer have the threat of a felony that you have to serve time for, the ability to entice people accused of crimes here that we will lower your penalty to a misdemeanor from a felony so that you enter the substance abuse program, that was eliminated as a result of Prop 47. And that fuels a large part of the support side, is being able to funnel folks into substance abuse programs or mental illness health programs. And that's part of the support also. It's not solely tough on crime. That mentality you referenced, Kathleen, back to the 80s and 90s, when the California correctional peace officers are always in the top three or four of the most influential groups. They are the largest funder of this proposition as well. And I hope I answered your question.
You did indeed. And I appreciate your wisdom. Thank you to all of the panelists. I wish we had more time. There's so much to unpack here, but I really appreciate you helping us learn a little bit more about these propositions. So Ben Christopher, election reporter for Cal Matters, Olivia Allen Price, host of KQED's Bay Curious podcast, Jeremy White, California political reporter for Politico, and Mark Trezza, political science instructor at Fresno City College. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having us.